Okay, call to order. Mic's on. Call to order the regular meeting of the Oceana Community Service District Board of Directors on Wednesday, January 25th. May we have the roll call?
Director Burnett?
Here.
Director Angelo?
Here.
Director Colwell?
Here.
Vice President Austin?
Here.
President White?
Here. Okay, I'll ask Mr. Colwell to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Agenda review.
Madam President?
Yes, sir.
Two items. Ms. Cassiola will explain a slight change in the cash disbursements item. And then we also request that item 7G on the consent agenda be pulled for separate discussion. Legal counsel is going to go through some amended documents that are going to be presented to your board for consideration tonight.
Okay. Thank you.
And Ms. Cassiola then?
So for the amendment to 7C, we're going to remove $40 from the CSDA check for the dinner on Friday. And on Friday, we had two people that couldn't make it anymore, so $40 less to the CSDA.
Okay. Anything else from the board? Or staff?
No, it's just at the appropriate time, then, the recommendation would be for the approval of the consent agenda, excluding item 7, as amended, but excluding item 7G.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on, public comment of items not on the agenda for the evening.
Good evening, I'm John Clemens. I'm a resident of Oceano. And I'd like to welcome the new board. I'm really kind of excited about seeing the new board, so I'm looking forward to some good things going on in Oceano. And the progress that the last board had began, that it continues. So, with that, there's still an issue that I noticed last budgeting period that I would hope that this board would revisit. During the budget process, we looked and money in the 2-year time frame. There's $1.1 million budgeted to go to sewer, but only 10% of that, or only 100,000 of the million, is actually scheduled to be used in the sewer in the form of services. So you only have 10% of money that ratepayers are paying for a specific issue going to that service. 65% of it is going to admin allocation. One of the problems with admin allocation is it's non-specific. It doesn't even say what that money's going to or what it's being used for. It just says admin allocation. I know in listening to the director, to general manager, that this was a situation that was put in place before he got here. So I understand that part of it. But now that we recognize it, you have $1 million in sewer. You're only spending $100,000. I work in the sewers around here. I've had to replace 3 entire pipes in the last 3 years. So I can't imagine that your pipes are a whole lot better. It would be nice, I believe, to have the money that's going for sewer repair to go into that fund and be used. One of the suggestions around here lately has been that ratepayers would pay an additional $5 for the, the laterals. Well, imagine if you had that extra $650,000, then maybe the ratepayers don't have to pay it extra. You could apply that to the lateral program. There's been a lot of heavy rains lately. I know for a fact, because I receive your water, that your lift stations are struggling. I know that because there's a lot in I&I, there's a lot of places that need to be repaired and shored up. And so it's difficult to understand why we would take the money that's meant for that sewer. You know, if you had a surplus, if your sewers were great, that would be one thing. But since your sewers are probably not in real good condition, and we need to find out as soon as possible, rectify any I&I situations, repair any lift stations that need to be lifted, then I think that money would be much better spent in the sewer system repairing the sewers. And so I would hope that your board would look at that allocation, review it, and maybe see if we can't get that money spent on repairing our sewer system.
Thank you.
Good evening, I'm Julie Tacker, and just to help with John's message, I&I is inflow and infiltration. So if you didn't know what that meant, maybe that helps you and those at home who are watching. Tonight I wanted to speak, sort of piggybacking on what I brought up 2 weeks ago when I suggested that some of you make it to the Coastal Commission hearing on the OHV operation. And that discussion is going to continue, so you will have another chance in the next year to attend a Coastal Commission hearing here locally about that item. I also mentioned that State Parks has an EIR and a project in place or in process for dust control. They will still need permits. You again have an opportunity to speak on that project. But what is coming around again is the appeal of the Phillips 66 project will be heard by the County Board of Supervisors the week of March 13th through 17th. They'll visit the project on the 13th, being a Monday, and they'll take as long as they need that week to hear the entire project. I ask that your board take a position. Since some of you are new, you might think that taking a position on a land use project like that may not be something that your board should weigh in on. But my point in that the Community Services District should speak out is that your infrastructure crisscrosses under that railroad track throughout your community. Every bit of sewer and water line lighting at all is in the blast zone. And should there be an accident with that project, you should be compensated. You should ask up front that there be mitigation measures in place for the health and safety of not only your community members, but the infrastructure that belongs to those community members, and that you, as board members, are the fiduciary responsible people who maintain and see that that infrastructure stays just as healthy as the people in your community. So there are opportunities for your board to be heard, and I'd like to see you take a stand, be on record, and you have plenty of time between now and the March hearing to agendize the item, and I wish you would, and have that discussion and come up with what you believe is the best position for your community.
Thank you. Any other public comments? I'll move on to special presentation and reports. Mr. Marciano?
Good evening, Board. Tony Marciano. For the past couple weeks, we've had our daily rounds, samples, work orders. We've had 9. We've had 10 USAs. The USA's underground service alert kind of went up because there's a company from Ventura that's going to be replacing quite a bit of gas main on Beach Street. If you might notice a lot of signs out, you got the company out there going to be replacing a few blocks of gas main and then also going to the houses. So a lot more USAs for us. Customer service calls, we've had 4 of them. We had 2 after hours call outs. One was for an unlock, and the other one, we had a power outage at the yard. As you know, the storms have been, you know, keeping us busy here and there. All right, we're continuing to locate sewer laterals for cleanouts. We had door hangers, approximately 80 plus of those. We installed a new service on North Swing, lock-offs, meter reads. Meter reads, time-consuming, a few days there. Re-reads, leak notifications to customers that do have leaks when we go back out to do re-reads for high consumptions or low consumptions. All right, and then, over at the Oceano Depot, you got your Century Wells over there. So myself and Jason went out there to measure the depths, see if the water has risen at the Century Wells. So GSI measured them January 10th. I measured them today. Okay, everything has gone up from the 10th. It's gone up. All the wells, the monitoring wells, have gone up at least 2 feet, which is really good. But this time last year, they were actually higher. So we are going in the right direction, but we're still not even where we were last year at the same time. Now, as for Lopez, Lopez is at 33.8%, which is 16,671 acre feet. Now, that's gone up quite a bit. But as you all know, we use a little over 8,000 acre feet a year amongst the municipalities and the downstream release. So we need probably about another 3,500 acre feet to get that 1 year's worth of supply. So right about 20,000 acre feet. So we're in the right direction, hopefully some more rain. Everything else seems to be going pretty good. Any questions?
Thank you.
Any questions?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.
Next up is, nice to see you, Fire Chief Steve Lieberman, Five Cities Fire Authority. You want to give just a quick update? And I know you'll be on the program later.
Thank you. Just quickly to tag onto what Tony just spoke about with regards to the storm. In that 24-hour period on Sunday when we had the wind event, we responded to 30 calls for service. A typical 24-hour period for us is 10 calls for service. So us, along with a lot of allied agencies, were very busy, mainly with wind-related incidents, trees down, power lines down. The strangest thing we saw was a full-size trampoline in Arroyo Grande get lifted over a 6-foot fence and into the power lines. It was really quite a day. As far as our closing out our calendar year 2016 activity, we finished, the department finished at just under 3,500 calls for service in 2016, which is a 5.62 increase, a percent increase. Typically, we're 3% year over year. So we had quite a bump last year. And as you know, when I was new, I was directed to work with CAL FIRE to revise the automatic aid and mutual aid agreement. And that revision, the intent was to keep our resources in the service area more and out of the county and incorporated areas. And that revision's worked dramatically with a reduction of almost 47% in responding outside the service area. So definitely more information coming on that, but I just wanted to touch base with you on our storm response. Thank you.
Thank you. General Manager,
Madam President, so on our next meeting, for staff reports, will strike me from the Zone 3 Advisory Committee since Director Brene is now going to be on the committee. I think the Board of Supervisors' ratification of your appointment is, well, it's definitely going to be before the March meeting, but I think it's going to be within the next couple weeks. Obviously, most of my items are on the agenda. I did attend the State Water Subcontractors Advisory Committee with board members, as well as the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. So as board member reports are being made, if there's anything, I might add a couple of comments in there. Just a couple other items. So I got communications from Cal OES on our local hazard mitigation plan, the grant, in order to be able to prepare what's the LHMP, is Local Hazard Mitigation Plan. And they had previously, several months ago, included it in California's package to submit to FEMA. And so we need to do a couple modifications to our request tomorrow, and then they're going to send that along to FEMA. But the point is that the longer we're staying in the process, the better the odds are that we're going to actually get a grant. And so my discussions with the individual up in Sacramento today was along those lines. And I, best I can say is we have to be cautiously optimistic because can't count on anything unless you actually have it in hand. But she certainly seemed positive of in terms of our chances there. She mentioned there's a number of other agencies like ours that have to make some slight modifications to the request, and then it will be submitted to FEMA again. Tomorrow and Friday, representatives from the Department of Water Resources will be in town regarding the Prop 84 grant that was awarded and which your board did the budget adjustment on in December. So we're moving forward ahead with that. And kind of concurrent with the DWR grant, the State Water Board has also agreed to fund two efforts of technical assistance to go along with those, that work efforts. The RCAC, and I'm trying to remember the words behind that acronym, but it's a nonprofit agency up in California, and they'll be helping us with putting together financing applications with the State Water Board when we're further down the process. But what type of infrastructure we need, and then what does that mean in terms of potential funding from the State Water Board? So RCAC is going to be is being funded by the State Water Board to help us with those application processes. And that's good because whether it's for State Water Board or other funding agencies, you know, there's always differences in every application, but just to get help with the basic will go a long way. And then they've also funded Rural Cal Water, they're going to be in late spring or early summer here for a week. A team is going to be in town for a week to do leak detection for free. It's a week time. Mondays and Fridays are basically their travel days. Some of them come from San Diego, some from Northern California. So in advance of their visit, Tony and I and will look at where we want to prioritize their time, but we have, you know, 3 days worth of free leak detection. So in addition to the DWR grant, State Water Board is also funding some experts for technical assistance. That money also is part of Proposition 1, so the State Water Board has an allocation of Prop 1 funding to provide technical assistance for some communities. So more good news on terms of resources that are available. And of course, because the budget adjustment was done, I've initiated the efforts on starting to put together a request for proposals from those firms that were shortlisted last year. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay, nobody's here from the sheriff's office. So let's move on to board of directors committees. Should we go alphabetical? Director Angelo?
I did not have any committee meetings yet.
Do you want to give a report on the...
On the what?
On the dunes thing?
The dune? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
What dune thing? I'm sorry. There's going to be a grand opening celebration at the Oceano District's Visitor Center on...
Pier Avenue.
And it will start at 11 o'clock. It will be a ribbon-cutting ceremony, and exhibit hall opens, wildlife viewing at the Oceano Lagoon. 12 o'clock, the Guyton Hall opening, and the Monarch Butterfly presentation, origami craft activities. And at 1 o'clock, nature walk at Oceano Lagoon. 3 p.m. will be the visitor center is to close. It's a beautiful site they've developed. It's taken them some time. We've all been kind of waiting, so... It's going to be a special event. I think everybody in the community should probably try to go and see what they've done with our history and our little dunes district here.
I have a question. When are they going to open the campground? Or is it open again?
It's open now. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So if just one more, we can repeat. The day is on what day?
It's on Friday, January 27th, a week from this week. No, 2 days.
And 2 days. And it's...
Yeah.
The start time is at?
At 11 o'clock.
11 o'clock.
And it's on 555 Pier Avenue.
Here you go. Next report, alphabetical. Vice Chair, Vice President Austin.
There was no sanitation meeting this last time, so I don't have anything to report other than we did get an email from the general administrator, and that during the storms the plant operated very well. There was no problems. He commended the staff and everyone at the plant for getting through the storm with great functionality.
Director Brunet?
Yes, and I attended two meetings, both the State Water Committee Advisory Committee meeting, and I know I'll allow Director Caldwell to take that on, as he's the primary. But I did also attend my first Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting this past Thursday. A few of the highlights, and Tony covered a little bit regarding the reservoir increase, so we're all very much as community members, you know, crossing our fingers and hoping that'll continue to go up and up. One of the topics they wanted to bring up, which I know was in the Tribune, but was regarding the downstream releases, and specifically, you know, over the past with the rains and everything, I think some local residents were up there and seeing the dam actually releasing water downstream in concern of, well, the lake's, you know, not full yet, why would we be doing that? But that's a part of policy, part of regulations, how they broke it up in a percentage that I thought was really great. And the intake that the lake had been pulling in, 97.2% was being retained, only 2.8% was being let go. And that's, again, in order for fish and wildlife, for the downstream water rights, and as well as the different species and stuff, steelhead and things of that nature. So to hopefully relieve any concerns that we're just letting all the water go. They're doing a fantastic job of keeping with the regulations and policies set forth. So another item that was real big was the proposed budget for 2017-2018, and that there are going to be some increases. Specifically, there in regard to looking at this past year, all the water treatment that had to take place, looking at the low water quality, having to make sure that was taken care of before going into the plant, and the health checks that also they had to make. And then as well as a new engineer for the district, and it's going to be, they're going to be dedicated just to the district, and with aging infrastructure there and projects that they need a full-time engineer. So for Oceano, it's looking like roughly about a 1.48% increase, which in speaking with our general manager, that is within our CPI increase that falls under the 218 here of 1.5%. So that was already going to be something that the 1.5% was going to be, would be taking care of that Lopez increase, proposed increase as of now. And the other item was AT&T cell tower that has gone both to the county and as well as to the advisory committee and will be going to the Board of Supervisors. That'll be on the upper Lopez Canyon Road, the High Ridge Trail. It's a 60-foot tower with 8-foot antennas. They're supposed to make it look like, you know, a pine tree. But, you know, one of the things that the Pismo Beach mayor discussed was how, you know, that's a big increase for, you know, something like safety and that nature. So it did pass the advisory committee there and will be going on to the board supervisors. And I did want to talk about for under future agenda items, I had just as an overall to put on the agenda and kind of just an outreach, something that I'm passionate about. And I know here within Oceano, there can be opportunity. But for us as community members and around here working together, specifically when it comes to water resources, with some of the challenges that the state water emergency program has, that, you know, there are, you know, we can reach out to one another as communities, you know, located here to be able to help one another out. So, in which that was received very, very well by all the community members up that were represented. And I think that concludes my report.
Quick clarification and quick add-on. The discussion of future agenda items that Director Brunet was discussing was the idea that at the Zone 3 Advisory Committee, they should schedule that as a future agenda item as well. So obviously it's been, you know, on your agenda multiple times. I expect it's going to be back on your agenda again. But Director Brunet was urging the Zone 3 Advisory Committee as a whole to talk about that.
Thank you. And
then the add-on comment is simply that, as Director Brunet mentioned, there are some releases for the dam and for environmental regulatory as well as some groundwater recharge, because the upper ends of the creek are really influenced by the dam. The lower portions have Los Barros Creek and others that are feeding into it. And the reason I just want to sort of reiterate Director Brunet's comments is that I've had people who have approached me making the specific statement of, why is Lopez releasing water for flood purposes? There is this impression that the county was releasing water in order to gain capacity in the reservoir in case we have big rainfalls, but, you know, it's still two-thirds empty. So it's not for flood control for protection purposes. It's as Director Brunet had indicated.
Thank you.
Thank you. Director Caldwell?
As mentioned earlier, Pavo, Mr. Brunet, and myself all attended the State Water Contractors Advisory Committee. It was an interesting meeting. It was so full, we ran overtime, contrary to President White's edict here. In any event, the first item on that agenda was basically a review of what happened within the jurisdiction in 2016. One of the interesting things that did come up in that discussion was that the California State weather forecaster says, we're gonna have a wet January, and then February, March, and April are gonna be dry. So despite the last couple of weeks and all the rain that we've got, we could be looking at a very dry few months ahead. And, of course, that's what we're all concerned about, particularly with the last years and the drought. Additionally, there was a discussion concerning the ongoing option study for the Paso area, Paso Robles. There was a significant discussion, although it was really the beginning of this discussion concerning the possibility of an emergency exchange of water and an agreement among the subcontractors, including us, with the State Water Committee. We need a lot more work there, and I would sure like to see there be some discussion among the various subcontractors, including the Oceano District, concerning how there might be an interim agreement by the subcontractors which need additional water rather quickly, and ourselves as an example, because we have some extra water that we might be able to sell. But we got a ways to go in those discussions. And hopefully it does lead to an agreement, because I think it'd be good for everyone. And it would also facilitate discussion among the agencies. Well, we'll report again when we have an additional meeting.
Thank you.
Again, a little bit more follow-up on that. So part of the discussion, so you're at the last meeting, your board adopted an advocacy platform on the State Water Emergency Program, seeking contract amendments with equitable pricing and revenue sharing between the county and the state water subcontractors. The good news from the meeting is that the county representative, the primary deputy director, Mark Hutchinson, certainly used the contract amendment language a lot, and it looks like we're going to be heading in that direction. And that's good, because it helps to make sure everybody's around the table and going through the details. From the Department of Water Resources, though, it was clear that the vision that the county had for the agreement with Santa Barbara County and San Luis Obispo County and the Department of Water Resources to bring more emergency water into the Central Coast, that DWR's restrictions, again, that's the Department of Water Resources state, It will likely mean that the program has less certainty than how the county had envisioned it. And it's really that less certainty about the emergency program that then leads to Director Brunet's comments at Zone 3 that, look, we need to look at our local water resources and how can we coordinate, as well as Director Colwell's comments that we, you know, we really need to look at these things from Director Brunet from the Zone 3, the Lopez standpoint, and those contractors, Director Colwell from the state water contractors, what can we do in the interim, separate from the emergency program, to help shore up local needs in case we don't get any more rain through February, March, or April. And so all of these issues really tie together. Again, the summary is that there is significant work to be done on the emergency, and the gray news is that the Department of Water Resources restrictions give us less optimism about the emergency program in the future, and therefore we'll likely need more reliance on those local resources that we do have.
Thank you. And I, along with other members of the board, went to a ethics class, which I found extremely interesting, actually. Thought I knew everything. And they balanced it between ethics, which is what you ought to do or what you should do, and then ethics law, what you must do. And among the two, it was a two-hour class, very, very comprehensive. But one of the major things I got out of it is if you think you have a conflict of interest in one way or the other, a neighbor, you have to, a neighbor's house is what's being discussed, or just anything. If you think you have a conflict, you probably do, so just don't vote. Just leave the room. And if you have a conflict, you have to leave the room. You can't sit in the audience and make faces to the other board members. And they dealt a lot with giving away public resources or funds, like, you know, we're not going to lend our OCSD pickup truck for somebody who needs to move furniture. It just isn't going to happen, so please don't ask. We just can't share like that. And there was a lot of other principles. And they also suggested that for small groups like ours, that we don't tie ourselves up in operating under Robert's Rules of Order. We don't get lost in the minutiae of how we run a meeting, but instead get very involved in actually doing the business that we need to do. So, thank you. It was very interesting. And public comment on our comments? Reports, I should say.
Julie Tucker, and I'll just ask, because Pavel was talking about the FEMA item, and I wondered where you are with your local hazard mitigation plan, because I don't think you have one. I'm pretty sure you don't, and I know you need one. And does this, well, that's for another day, but that's the question.
Thank you. Mr. Ogren?
Well, certainly. So the local hazard mitigation plan that was prepared by Five Cities Fire Authority a few years ago did not include the community Oceano CSD, not through any fault of the Five Cities Fire Authority, but at that point in time, for whatever reason, OCSD just did not participate in the development of that LHMP. But that's the purpose of seeking the grant money through CalEOAS and FEMA, is to obtain the funds in order to prepare a local hazard mitigation plan. The benefits of the plan are essentially multiple for different agencies, but without an LHMP, you can't apply for certain federal funds, which in reality we don't need. Unlike the county needed an LHMP in order to apply for funds to fix the levee system. So the importance of the LHMP for us is understanding what the risks are in the community and part of our emergency response. But we've applied for the grant revenues in order to prepare the plan, and it's still going to be a little bit of time to find out whether or not we receive those funding, but we'll find out soon.
I have a question. Aren't we included in the county's plan, disaster plan, mitigation plans?
Yeah, that's an important distinction because to the extent that the county has flood control and drainage responsibilities, their local hazard mitigation plan does cover the community of Oceano. So the community is covered in those like vital risks, especially that's called the pre-disaster mitigation funding. And that's really about the flood control and the levees. So the community is covered through the county's plan. It's the additional risks that we face, whether it's earthquakes or tsunamis, that, you know, what are our risks for Oceano CSD? And our vision of the plan is also to provide that additional public information to inform the community of the different types of risks. But the biggest one on the floodings and the levees and everything that we know is out there, yes, the community is covered through the county's plan.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam President?
Yes.
Can I make one further kind of clarification just to piggyback off of the Zone 3 as well as the state water?
Sure.
And Director Caldwell had kind of talked about the forecast for the next few months. The other thing, just as a reminder, is that, you know, our area is still considered an extreme or exceptional drought. So even with the massive rains that we've had, which is great, you know, we're still in a hard spot. So just as a reminder. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, so we move on consent agenda items. Public comment.
Julie Tacker again, and I just wanted to speak to your last meeting's minutes in that I am reminded that when I spoke to the sanitation district report, I mentioned that the recycled water program had been before the board and that I wanted your board to look at the possibility of dovetailing the redundancy project and the recycled project off-site. And Pavo came back. I think Mr. Brunet asked that, you know, maybe we expand that discussion, but Pavo said he was going to talk about it in the later item, item 8A, which was the, what's that word, advocacy platform and the reclaim water efforts, and then that subject didn't come back. And I hope that you actually do talk about the redundancy project at the sanitation district and see that it perhaps is something that could be done in concert with the recycled project offsite and out of Oceano. It's your turn's over for that site.
Thank you.
Madam President, I very well may have missed following up on the comment last meeting. I think one of the questions we should address during future agenda items is, do we want to invite Administrator Gerhardt from the Sand District to come and do an overview of some of their efforts? So that's a possibility as well.
Thank you. Yeah. Anything else on consent? I'll entertain a motion.
Oh, again, so item 7G is going to be pulled, so it would be a recommended action would be approval of the consent agenda as modified, excluding item 7G for separate discussion.
I'd move that we approve the consent agenda as discussed, including the modification of removal of subsection G.
Second.
I'll second it.
Oh, okay. Been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 5-0. Now we can move on to item 7G, approval of a recommendation to authorize the general manager and legal counsel to amend the district's conflict of interest code pursuant to county review. And I do think that needs a roll call vote, doesn't it?
Yes, President White and directors of the board. As you are aware, in July last year, your board adopted an amended conflict of interest code to add the business consultant item. The county expressed concern because Appendix 2 identifies consultants as being on our list of designated parties, but they were not identified on Appendix 1. So we have before you a new resolution because we need to adopt the conflicts of interest code by resolution, and this would just simply make an amendment to that clerical issue to put the consultants on as designated representatives. And so with that, if you have any questions.
Any questions?
No. It would result in a revised recommendation, though, and that is to approve a resolution amending and restating a resolution of the directors of the Oceano Community Services District amending and restating its conflict of interest code. And as legal counsel pointed out, it's for the clerical clarification in Appendix 1. I would recommend separate public comment on this item as well.
Okay. Any more discussion from the board? Then I'll call for public comment on this item. Seeing nobody come forward, move back to the board. Are we ready to make a motion?
Yeah, I guess I'll make a motion that we approve a resolution of the Board of Directors of the Oceano Community Services District amending and restating its conflict of interest code.
Second.
Roll call vote, Madam Clerk.
Vice President Austin?
Yes.
Director Angelo?
Yes.
Director Brunet?
Yes.
Director Colwell?
Yes.
President Wayne?
Yes. Passes 5-0. Okay, move on to business items. 8A, consideration of a request of the Five Cities Fire Authority to approve the purchase of a second replacement fire engine at an estimated cost of approximately $550,000. Chief Lieberman and Mr. Ogren.
That's correct, Madam President. Most of my comments are in the staff report. I'll probably add something real brief after Chief Lieberman's discussion.
Okay, thank you. Chief?
Madam President and Board, good evening. Steve Lieberman, your fire chief. At the Friday the 13th, Friday, January 13th, the Five Cities Fire Authority Board met and discussed an opportunity to purchase a second fire engine, as you know or may know. We have one in final production at Pierce Manufacturing, Wisconsin. It's anticipated to be delivered in March. Pierce came to us and said, if you order a clone of the current engine in production, we're willing to offer you a discount. That discount amounts to a little over $50,000 or 9%. The catch was a purchase order needs to be cut, processed on or before February 1st. So with this sense of urgency at the Friday the 13th meeting, I'm sorry, that makes me laugh, the board members all agreed to go to their member communities and present this opportunity. Monday, I was in Grover Beach. The Grover Beach Council voted 5-0 to support moving forward. I was in Arroyo Grande last evening with an identical vote with that council. And here I am before you to answer any questions and present additional information to you on the same topic. Excuse me. We do have a special board meeting scheduled for this Friday where the board members will reconvene and share the outcomes and make final direction known to myself and legal counsel as to whether we are going to move forward with the transaction or not. Again, Friday's the 27th.
the purchase order needs to be cut no later than February 1st. At the meeting on the 13th, board asked us to have some preliminary discovery discussions with financing options. We've been doing that. It looks as though, and again, an interest rate isn't known until you lock the transaction, but right now we're looking at a interest rate of somewhere just over 3% for a 10-year lease purchase. Grover Beach chose to finance their portion of the purchase. The Arroyo Grande City Council last evening stated their preference is to pay cash for their portion, which is over $260,000, but they don't want to jeopardize financing for any of the other member communities, and so there's going to be flexibility that will be discussed on Friday. Again, just a little bit of background, and I know I met many of you during your board orientation. The fleet today, with the exception of the aerial truck 5, is the equipment that was brought into the formation of the fire authority in 2010. It all was of different ages and service cycle in 2010, and there's been no replacement. If you walk into the Oceano Fire Station this evening, you'll see Oceano's Legacy Engine 4 parked backwards because it failed the state pump test and it's out of service. The first out engine here is the state-owned Office of Emergencies Engine 386. When I spoke to the board on the 13th, we're at a critical point, and it's never a good time to look at an investment of $555,000. I told you about this fire station in Grover Beach this evening. Engine 2 is the first out engine. Engine 3 is the reserve for our fleet, but Engine 3 is an engine that's got at least $15,000 in electrical issues outstanding on it and is scheduled for replacement. At the Arroyo Grande Fire Station this evening, Truck 5 is our only first out municipal fire apparatus. We also have the brush engine, which you saw at Station 1. So in a perfect world, we need to have first out municipal Type 1 fire engines at each of the fire stations, and we need to have two Type 1 engines in ready reserve. By purchasing the second engine, which is about a 13-month manufacturing process, we'll have modern equipment first out at Stations 2 and 3, Grover Beach and Oceano. We will move the 2007 Pierce, which is engine 2 currently, into reserve status, so we'll have a relatively new reserve engine, and then we will have to make a decision on the three older engines as to which to put some taxpayer dollars into to have as a ready reserve as well. I'm very sensitive to spending money on fully depreciated assets, but that's the place where we stand today. So I did share a photo with the board. Engine 1, which is a 1996 high-tech engine, which was bought used from Sparks, Nevada, was towed yesterday to South Coast maintenance in Paso because the braking system was so deficient that it couldn't be driven over the grade. So, again, we're at critical levels. I'd love to answer any questions or provide any additional information to President Board Chair White. Thank you.
Madam President, my supplemental comments are simply that in the staff report, while I support the recommendations and the requests of Chief Lieberman on this particular item, the bigger concerns about funding for Five Cities Fire Authority are all the things that are still going to follow. The breathing apparatus is a significant item that the chief is pursuing grant funding on. And in some ways, those are just the tip of the iceberg. We all need to remind ourselves that with the formation of the Five Cities Fire Authority, we recognize that there is going to be shortfalls in funding. There had been a vote that did not pass in order to provide supplemental funding. The issue's not going away, so I wanted to make sure to provide a little bit more details on some of the challenges that we're facing. But certainly, given the condition of the fleet, the ability to take benefit of the discount that's being offered, I certainly support and recommend providing President White with the appropriate direction to go back to the Five Cities Fire Authority so that this can be pursued, and be glad to answer any questions as well.
And I suppose the only thing in support of all this I would say is that looking at the statistics for last year, 67% of our calls were EMS, were medical calls. And I sometimes think we should change the name to the Five Cities Emergency and Fire Department, because we are doing so many other things that have just as much need in the county, in the communities as fire. like people who aren't breathing and need instant resuscitation. And we need to get there, and we have saved people. And we'll continue to save people. So it's not just the 2.3% fires we went to last year. It was a 67% EMS. The various little calls, the false alarms, the service calls, the good intention calls. The service calls, like 3 o'clock in the morning, an old couple's smoke alarm is screaming, and they're scared, and they call 911, and the fire department comes out and checks things out, checks their houses out, fixes their smoke alarm, makes sure they're safe. I think we have to have the equipment to get there. I think it's critical. And so I'm supporting it, but you guys are the ones who are going to need to vote on this.
I would like to say, too, thank you for the tour that we had a few weeks ago, being able to see each of the stations, as well as to get a little bit of history and seeing the state it's that some of the fleet as well as the equipment is in and being able to actually look at it. I think it's amazing that we have a deal like this that's already here, to be able to save $50,000 because, again, it's not a question of replacing, this, it's just when are we going to do it? And being able to get somewhat of a deal on it, I think, is great. So I thank you very much for the initiative in this, too, and that they approached us for this. So, yeah, I'm definitely in favor. Absolutely.
I would probably call for a motion for an actual vote on this.
I've got a question.
Okay, but we also need public comment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about the EMS calls and things like that. Is there a vehicle that can be used separate from a fire truck for those type of calls, kind of like their own little ambulance type setup thing? Would that help relieve on the fire trucks being taken out all the time for these type of calls?
Yeah, it's definitely an option, and it's been experimented with going back to when I was a volunteer. We had a squad in Grover Beach, and actually at the beginning of the Five Cities Fire Authority, since there was a squad in Grover Beach and it became part of the inventory, it was attempted at one point. But what that does with, at this station, when we have two people on duty 24 hours a day, they have to choose a vehicle to respond to. At the other stations where there's three people, you need to send two people for assistance with that call. A lot of times you need that third person if CPR is involved.
Right.
And importantly, if you took the squad with two people and then a structure fire broke or a vehicle accident, that leaves one person operating the fire engine and trying to get our staffing all there. So trying to keep everyone together is in crew cohesion.
Yeah.
That's been the priority.
Okay. I do believe we do need a new fire truck. I have seen them. I have heard about them. And it's like... Yes, we do need to have, we need more equipment. I understand that. It's just the cost involved trying to get them, and it takes so long to get them manufactured.
Right.
But, yeah, if we can squeeze it through the budget, I think we need to do this because we're getting down to two trucks, basically.
One question. I would assume there would be a little advantage in having two identical trucks, wouldn't there? I mean, the fact that you're on truck A, and then you can go to truck B, and they're identical.
It would be great that they're configured identically. I mean, we try to have the compartment space, regardless of which fire engine it is, have the same tools in it. But let me touch on something that came up in Grover that's, I believe, related to your question. One of the council members in Grover Beach said, well, why can't we just shop around and take this discount to other manufacturers? By choosing someone like Pierce as our base manufacturer and our standardization, there's several advantages. Pierce has become the de facto manufacturer for all the municipal fire departments in this county. And importantly, most importantly to me and to our department, is we don't have a staff state-licensed fire mechanic. We do not have that employee. So when South Coast opened a service facility in Paso Robles a year and a half ago with Pierce factory-trained service technicians, that was a huge benefit to us and the other departments that don't have full-time mechanics. So definitely a plus for standardization.
Yeah. Thank you. Public comment on this item?
Julie Tacker, and obviously you need a fire truck, and I support the decision before you to seek this deal. My larger questions are related to how do you avoid this in the future? Making decisions under pressure, making decisions about setting aside funds for sinking funds for replacement, and particularly for the district's side of what you do for Five Cities Fire, and that you provide housing and a station. In 2009, when I first started coming to these meetings, Rafael Montemiro, the general manager at the time, took great pride in that he climbed a ladder and walked on the roof, and he came down and said that he'd had other roofers, experts, tell him that it needed replacement. 2009, there were bids in front of the board at the time to replace the roof. That never happened. Was the roof not in need of replacement, or is it 8 years later and the roof is in further disrepair and you don't have the resources to repair it? I've not heard any more about the roof in Mr. Ogren's tenure, and that continues to concern me, in that what is your backup plan for your part of the bargain of Five Cities Fire Authority, and that you have responsibilities to house those engines, good, brand new ones or old ones, in a healthy fire department?
I would entertain a motion, I think. I don't have the paper. Hang on.
Okay. It's with great pleasure. I would like to make a motion that we consider authorizing President White as the chair of the Five Cities Fire Authority to vote in favor of purchasing a second replacement fire engine at an estimated cost of approximately $555,000 with financing over a 10-year period.
Little clarification on the motion. The inclusion of the word consider would probably want to be stricken from your actual motion.
I'd like to recommend that we authorize President White to vote in favor of the new fire engine.
Second?
I'd second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. 5-0. Thank you.
Thank you.
Move on to 8B, consideration of a recommendation to approve a utility relocation agreement with the County of San Luis Obispo in conjunction with the County Highway 1 Drainage Project. Approve a budget adjustment and payment in the amount of $109,868. Authorize the general manager to file a notice of exemption pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act and provide direction on alternative bidding procedures. My first question is this four actions? I believe it is.
President White, it's entirely appropriate at the appropriate time for your board simply to make a motion of approving staff recommendations, which would encompass all of the recommendations. You don't need to take them one at a time. In the event that any of them might want to be modified by your board, then you might want to go through them one at a time, but it's not necessary. I'm going to keep my comments relatively brief because I think the staff report lays out all the details. We've discussed this item, generally over the last several months. The key issue here is that we don't really have discretion. This is a mandated effort that we're required to do because we have utility lines in both county highways as well as state highways, and when they implement projects of this nature, we're mandated to move. Now, I worked really closely, legal counsel and I worked really closely in order to make sure we understood what our requirements were. And during the process with the county, we had them produce case law that went back to probably the first half of the 20th century. And it's really a combination of case law as well as statutory law that compels us to act. My basic question at the very front is that this is a drainage project. It's not a road surfacing project. It's not a road realignment project. Does a drainage project really count? Because again, legal counsel is going to be able to discuss this in greater detail. When I looked at the statutes and everything, it kept talking about highway projects. And it's really part of case law that is the one that points to the fact that a drainage project in order to take water off the highway is, in my sort of non-legal terms, it's still a highway project. So we're compelled to move forward. There's an impact to both the water fund and the sewer fund on these construction efforts, as I've identified. The soft costs associated with our district engineer appears that we're going to be able to absorb those costs within the current year budget. We will have to watch that closely because the current, including contingencies that we have in the current year budget, and we'll really provide an update again at the third quarter budget report. There is some possibility that the soft costs may require a budget adjustment later in the year. The other thing is that when the actual bid amounts come in, the dollar amounts might change, and we might have to come back for a budget adjustment on that point. During the review with legal counsel on what we were obligated to pay for, that's when, in working with the county, it was identified that we had the senior rights on Dolphin Avenue, and therefore the county has to pay for the construction cost on Dolphin Avenue. And to the extent that, you know, we've incurred some soft cost on looking at Dolphin Avenue, that's how we were able to negotiate a lower soft cost percentage down to 10% from the county. And there's a lot of back and forth on that, but I think that the ultimate outcomes end up being fair. The last thing I want to comment on is the alternative bidding procedures, because with the adoption of the Uniform Public Cost Accounting Act, Construction Cost Accounting Act, in 2016, we do have the ability to go out there and get informal bids, and we want to be able to do that for a couple of different reasons. One is to protect on the risk side in the event that the bids that the county receives for our utility relocation work is out of line. Now, the likelihood of that happening is really relatively low, but still it's a good thing to get alternative bids on, and it kind of sends a message to the contractors that if they play around with these additive items, because to clarify, the county's bid is for all of their work. Our work is an additive item. So the low bid is going to be awarded by the county based on their project. And so whatever that contractor who gets that low bid is, whatever they've bid on our work is what we've got from the county. And generally speaking, the contractors are, they don't play around with the alternative bids. But to go through the alternative bidding process is a good idea. But the other reason why I want to be able to pursue it is we just adopted that new act. And to get experience about getting the alternative bids out, to get them out on the bid board, and to follow all the procedures on the new act, it's a good opportunity. The other project that we're going to be doing that on in the very near future is the emergency generator. So we've got, you know, again, your board adopted the resolutions and the ordinance, and staff has some work to do in order to work through the process of following through. And this is a good opportunity to do that. So again, in summary, it's something that we're compelled to do, and I urge approval of the recommendations. Separate from the recommendations, I think that talking about community development block grant money a little bit, because again, we applied for some CDBG money in order to help with this project. The county staff recommendations came out this week, and out of the county's CDBG money, there are no funds recommended for public facilities from any of the unincorporated areas. And to the extent that the county has awarded itself some funding from CDBG for this project, one thing that we might want to entertain is that Vice President Austin is your board-appointed liaison to District 4 Supervisor Lynn Compton, and to have some discussion with her. CDBG monies are intended to offset community costs. The county's allocated it for their own costs. And at least to have that discussion, because if it ends up coming under budget, then would the Board of Supervisors entertain giving us some of the benefit of the CDBG money? Again, I don't really have that as a recommendation because the recommendations are focused on what we're compelled to do, the mandate side of this project. But I do think that some follow-up discussions with county and with Supervisor Compton on how this unfolded wouldn't hurt and might be helpful. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I don't have a question, but I certainly would compliment you on the work you've done to make sure that Oceano is getting its due, shall we say, both of you. And any questions?
I have one question. Is this going to be it for OCSD's portion regarding this project? Probably.
Well, when you say, is this going to be it? That's a loaded question, no matter what we're talking about. So this is substantially it. You know, this is the funding that we need to pay for the county, assuming that we use the county contractor. If we get alternative bids, then maybe we can do better. But there's always the possibility that bids are going to be more expensive, and I'd have to come back with a subsequent budget adjustment. When it came to the asphalt overlay project that was done in 2016, I guess the beginning part of 2016, it happened to be that the contractors bid right on with what the engineer's estimates were. And in some ways, these costs are a relatively minor cost in comparison to the project as a whole. And so you would expect that the contractors are going to be pretty close to engineer's estimate because, well, it's a little bit of additional work, and so they're going to be able to make a little bit of additional money. But in terms of if this is it, well, you know, it always kind of depends. If they trench a pipe and you find Native American artifacts, then it's not it. And those can be significant costs depending on what you find. I've been involved in projects where we have found burials. And so the number one rule is to avoid movement. You can move. You have to go through a lot of procedures, and you have to work with the most likely descendants. So the biggest risk is really if in the event that work is going on, that Native American site is found. And so it's actually because of the CDBG money and the federal funding that the county had to make sure to cover all their requirements associated with this project up front. So the likelihood probably is not great because a lot of times the Native American sites are on hills and other areas where there's good views, and a lot of times there are primary burial sites, especially if there's notables, chiefs, or other high-ranking, tend to be in really good view areas. And, of course, we're talking about a project that is historically closer to swampland.
So say it's in the floodplain.
Yeah. So, again, there's always some project risk, but it's just the likelihood of those types of issues are probably pretty low in this particular project.
Okay. So for the county's scope currently, this is
it. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So
okay.
We know we've got the scope nailed down. Right. It's a question of what are contractor bids going to come in at, and is there going to be something unforeseen? And every time you're working underground, you always have to be worried about unforeseen circumstances.
And in looking at the map, would this end up, or like regarding the 13th Street, the flooding that ended up happening, is this going to potentially alleviate that in the future? Or
so, yes. The county's approach to the project is specifically to help with alleviating 13th Street and some of the other
flooding that occurs around Highway 1, with 13th Street being the most significant. We need to be careful, though, when we use the word alleviate, because we know that it's not going to eliminate the flooding at 13th Street. And if Arroyo Grande Creek is flowing heavily, that always affects how fast water is going to move out of, you know, the lower Oceano area. So the best characterization is that it will reduce the frequency and the severity of flooding at 13th Street. But depending on what kind of rain event is happening and depending on what's going on with Arroyo Grande Creek, we still have to know that 13th Street is still going to flood from time to time. And even when it floods heavily, then the hope is that it's going to bleed off faster and it will drain faster. But it will not eliminate the flooding.
All right. Thank you.
Questions? I have one. Do we have a, so we, I guess you could call it a start date on this project? 2018, 2019?
Oh, it's this year. They're going to be going out to bidding pretty quickly.
Oh.
If we get alternative bids and we go that route, we have to have our work completed by May 31st.
Okay.
Because the county's basic position is you got to be done before we start. Now, the reality is if that direction is headed, I'll have some ability to talk to Director Wade at Public Works, Wade Horton, because there's always this effort of coordination of contractors. So the strict reading of the agreement is we have to be done by May 31st, but there's also the provision unless that date is modified by an agreement between Mr. Horton and myself.
Okay.
So that's the basic schedule. Yeah. We can expect then that they will be initiating their construction sometime soon after May 31st.
How long do they expect it to take?
You know, I did not check the duration of their work effort.
Because they might want to get started before it starts raining again.
Oh, yeah. The nature of a project of this size, I generally wouldn't expect it to be more than a few months.
Okay, thank you.
Because you're trenching and you're piping, you're not talking about structural issues like bridges and other things, and so there will be a fair amount of earth movement, but yeah, I think that they've factored in getting in and out in one dry season.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the audience? Comments from the audience?
I can ask questions too, and I have some. I wondered if, my name's Julie Tacker, by the way, the soft costs, do those include those of Mr. Minnery's firm? The other question I had is how much of the relocation water lines are lines that you would want to, might have wanted to replace anyway, and that you might actually have a value there because they were old? I question an answer, I don't know. And then a question you might be asking about the CDBG funds. The county has awarded themselves for this project $608,000 in CDBG funds for this. And that has kept Oceano from getting CDBG funds for other things that you might have been eligible for a considerable time, probably 3 or 4 years that you would have been eligible for funds. They considered that this project was important to Oceano, and so they awarded it to themselves. So I do like the idea that Ms. Austin speak to Ms. Compton and see if there's some massaging that could go on there and put some of that money on your side of the ledger, but they would have to fill that hole with something else, and I don't know what that would be.
Thank you. Entertain a motion.
Quick replies, because there are a couple of good questions in there. So on the soft costs, yes, that includes legal counsel's time. The CDBG money, if we get any sort of forgiveness, one of the benefits of not having it directly allocated to us is that if it's directly allocated to us, then we're responsible for federal environmental review. That's why my hope is that if the county and discussions with Austin, if they have some budgetary savings. They'll just basically reduce our cost burden, but not in reality allocating specifically CDBG money to us. If the county had been inclined to allocate CDBG money for our efforts on this grant, I had talked to Director Horton, and the idea is we would have said, okay, no, just allocate more to the county, and then the county would reduce our costs here. But planning isn't doing that. So I think the $608,000 is a significant amount of cost, and the discussion with Supervisor Compton is both if they come in under budget, can we get some of that savings? And secondly, because CDBG project money hasn't been allocated to Oceano, and we know we have CIP efforts coming forth in the near future, that our turn is coming up. And so I think it's a multiple type of, a two-tone type of conversation with Supervisor Compton.
Thank you. Motion?
I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve a utility relocation agreement with the County of San Luis Obispo in conjunction with the county's Highway 1 drainage project. Approve a budget adjustment and payment in the amount of $109,868. Authorize the general manager to file a notice of exemption pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act and provide direction on alternative bidding procedures as proposed by staff report.
Second it.
Moving to second in. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 5-0. Thank you. Down to the last one. Introduction of amendments to the district's bylaws with direction as the board deems appropriate. Have we all read all this?
So, Madam President, I put forth a lot of information, not that your board needed to necessarily read all of it. And what I want to do is first talk a little bit about the approach I recommend, both in terms of considering amendments to the bylaws as well as the policies and the overall district's policies. That's a big goal for 2017. So I want to speak about that a little bit on how I envision going through that work effort and see if the board generally concurs. And then specifically to the bylaws, speaking about step one versus step two, my focus in the step one discussion tonight, which is going to take up most of the time of this agenda item, is attachment C, which is pages 101 through 104 of the agenda. And that has a half a dozen or so specific topics that are in the bylaws that I wanted to make sure to discuss with the board tonight and get at least informal feedback. There's really not a need to have formal motions tonight because there's no going to be no, you know, this is an introduction. It's not intended to be a final adoption of modification of the bylaws. So in talking about the approach overall, both with respect to the bylaws, which are essentially district policies, as well as the other district policies that we've had as a goal to start addressing. Things like personnel policies, which have to be compared to the memorandum of understanding that we have with Service Employees International Union, Local 620, and other policies. What I have included today is some information on the sample policies that have been developed by the California Special Districts Association. And the overall approach that I recommend as we're going through bylaws and other policies is to do this comparative analysis or comparison to what CSDA, again, the California Special Districts Administration, has developed in their sample policies. And in the staff report, I provide a couple of examples. So, for example, the state produces the Uniform Fire Code, the Uniform Building Code, Uniform Public, the Uniform Plumbing Code. And local agencies will adopt those state codes, and in doing so, they'll make the modifications to those state codes that reflect local preferences. But the idea is we all start with the same code And so there's a lot of consistency throughout California in uniform fire codes. As a fire code example, the question of whether or not fire marshals should be able to bear arms, because it's provided that they can carry arms. But a lot of agencies do not actually implement that portion of the Uniform Fire Code. I can imagine why in some neighborhoods they do, but especially on the Central Coast, I don't know that anybody does. Some of the agencies might. But again, by looking at the state code or another industry standard, in this case, policies and policies that are promulgated by the Special Districts Association, as we go through our policies then and talk about what we think makes sense or doesn't make sense, we have then the ability to compare to the sample policies that have been put out by one of the leading industry associations in California on the work that we do. So the idea with respect to the bylaws specifically, I've identified a number of items in our current bylaws that I think are worthy of some direction and feedback from the board. Step two then would be coming back and providing that comparison of what does the CSDA's policy on a particular topic say, what does our policy say, and does the board want to continue with our policy, go to the CSDA sample policy, or something else. And obviously, in going through the bylaws and all of our policies, this is going to take the better part of 2017. The idea is to have it as the last discussion item on the agenda, because then if we get up and we start facing, you know, the time on the clock that says the meeting's supposed to be over, this kind of discussion is easy then to continue to the next meeting, and we will just continue at a pace as best as we can. But I definitely prefer that approach, as opposed to legal counsel and I working through all of the policies and procedures, doing a whole bunch of red line and markup on them, and then putting it on your agenda and saying, hey, do you mind adopting these things? So we work on them together through the process. Then turning with respect to step number one, starting with page 101 of the agenda, I've identified about six different items just on the first review of our existing bylaws. Some of the initial feedback I got was, well, you know, codes allow for the teleconferencing. So if a board member happens to be in the hospital or on vacation in Switzerland and wants to participate in a meeting, that's legally permissible. Now, it's not either in our bylaws right now, nor is it in the CSDA policy. So I'm not going to really address that one today, but that's an example of another issue that we'll be addressing in step number two. Those other legal items that legal counsel has identified that we may want to talk about a little bit, because establishing some basic rules on teleconferencing is probably a good idea to be in the bylaws. It's a rare occasion. If it happens, there's procedure requirements that need to be followed, and sometimes it is a good idea. So,
it's been done here.
Yeah.
I did it. Lori's done it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so then out of the half a dozen items that I've identified, time and date of regular meetings, the basic two questions that I put forth is, does the board wish to consider a different start time for regular meetings? Should the general manager and president have the ability to cancel a meeting? And then the follow-up discussion was feedback that I have received a little bit, is what about starting the meeting with closed session? And there's some benefits to that. And some agencies start with closed session. One benefit is that if it's at the beginning of the meeting, you know, the idea is if we're in closed session, it's supposed to be an important issue. And doing it right up front when everybody is awake and ready and able to talk about it has gotten certain benefits. One of the thoughts is we start the meeting at 6:30. Some of the special districts do daytime meetings. I think that the thing to consider is your board might want to consider starting at 5 o'clock if possible, or soon thereafter, with closed session, and then regular meetings starting at 6 o'clock. That would get us a little bit of an earlier start time. I don't see challenges with it. Secondly, on the issue of should the general manager and president have the ability to cancel a meeting, I like that idea. As we know that November and December, it seems like we're typically canceling meetings because they're conflicting with Thanksgiving and Christmas and the holidays, and we take formal action in order to cancel a meeting. And, you know, it begs on some situations, why can't the GM and the president just make that call? So those are the only two items that I put under time and date of regular meetings and cancellation of meetings. And my thought is we would sort of take these and talk about them one at a time.
Right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. How do we feel about times of meetings? How does 5 o'clock feel to someone?
I think that sounds fine starting earlier. I think it would be better for everyone because you wait. I mean, I don't know.
What
work
about
schedules?
Dinner?
But, you know. But
that would be my only concern, would just be work schedules.
Well, and I was thinking more like our staff. Of course, if they wouldn't have to be there for the executive session, so they could go to dinner, thinking of our two ladies that.
So we
us.
Could definitely, staff, I mean, I think our general preference is to start the meetings earlier because then we have the ability to get home a little bit earlier. Obviously, these are always long days for us. And so if somebody needs to take off at 4 o'clock to get a bite to eat to be back at 5 o'clock, that works because we're all working longer than a normal work day anyhow. So I appreciate your concerns about staff, but I think that we generally like the idea of starting the meeting earlier.
I think Andrew may have some consideration about starting early, and we want to make sure we accommodate him. For me personally, starting earlier is perfectly fine. I like the idea of starting with the closed session because it should be the important stuff, and we need to address that directly and quickly.
I think to add, too, regarding closed session, maybe not necessarily always here, but in other districts I guess other districts, is, you know, sometimes closed session can take a while, and public would love to be a part of, you know, what comes after it. And so whether it goes really, really late, you know, people end up filtering out. So if they're really important issues, I agree. I think starting closed session's great. Regarding the time, I would just say was the recommendation not formal, but like close, if we have closed session to start at like 5 or even 5:30 and.
Well, I think that the question is really what works for board members, because the you know, staff can accommodate it. The public is general, even though there might be some comments in advance, normally the public's interested in, is there a reportable item out of closed session?
Right.
We can always structure to say that report out of closed session is going to be 6 o'clock at the start of the regular meeting because, you know, maybe closed session is 15 minutes. Sometimes, too, we might report out at 6 and say that, look, we're going to continue closed session after the regular session. Because if we went from, you know, if we got up to 6 o'clock, we're going to want to come back here into regular session, and we might have to reconvene closed session after the regular meeting. So it really still comes down to what's a start time that works for members of the board. Is it?
How many times have we ever had a closed session last more than an hour?
We have.
You have, okay, yeah.
Can't think of one in my tenure so far, but I do know that there is some items on closed sessions prior to me that I imagine lasted quite a long time. So
yeah, I guess. But
right,
I mean,
now,
that's
the good
rare.
News, it's good
that's
news.
Rare.
But
90% of the time, no.
Yeah.
Yes. Mr. Minery.
Directors, one other comment that I'd like to make as far as the benefit of closed session first is there's oftentimes matters that we will have on open session that we would like to discuss in closed session first. For example, things that are like final approval of revisions to the union MOU or things like that, where it's one last opportunity, and then that way we don't have to delay things and put things farther out, because if we come out of closed session and then it may help clarify the board's intent, but also you could pull things off the agenda later if you feel it's still unsettled. So that does provide a efficiency aspect.
And I've actually had real experience with that, where in a prior situation, which was closed session where we won't discuss it, there was a certain belief that there was a certain understanding that happened in closed session. A couple weeks go by, it's now an open session item, but clearly the meeting of the minds hadn't really happened, and so the open session discussion was a struggle. And as legal counsel had indicated, it really is the last opportunity to say, okay, this is what we think that, you know, your board was in, you know, heading the direction we were heading in. Are we sure that this is really your pleasure before going into open session? Again, it's rare, but in those kind of situations, when everybody pulls their hair out and say, oh, we didn't know that that's what we were talking about, then we'd go into open session and then just either continue that open session item or pull it from an agenda or, you know, do whatever, but just not speak to it. So it is a really good point from legal counsel's perspective as well.
Well, then it seems like it boils down to, Andrew, 5 o'clock or 5:30? Is that about where we're at?
5:15, 5:23.
Unfortunately, my wife's not here to check.
The decision maker.
Now, if you suggest 4:20, you're a judge.
It's only twice a month. It's only 2 days a month. If you
right. I would think 5:30. I think would actually work. Be doable. Yeah.
So, again, we're not looking for any final direction. I'll start working with 5:30 in terms of modifying it. If Director Brunet gets his spouse's final approval, maybe it's 5 o'clock. But
well, I'd like 5:30 better, too. Okay. But that's just so I can have something to eat.
Understood. So okay. On the topic of should the general manager and president have the ability to cancel a meeting?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know. Would that be in accord or each individual?
How did you do it before? I thought.
Yeah, that would be my question.
Oh, well, what we've done so far is it's actually an agenda item of the entire board.
But would it be one like the president could cancel it or the general manager two in accord?
Well, let's just say the president then, because I'm not going to do it unless you okay.
Well, then two in accord. No, but you might have a specific reason. And then two people in a court. I don't like any one person having the power to communicate.
I got you. Or any
two board members.
Yeah, part of me just thinks that that's the president's job, or lacking the president, if the president's not available, then the vice president is, you know, would be the second person. But, you know, again, we're talking about things like when we have conflicts with the holidays. It's hard to envision other situations. You could have an earthquake where we're like, look, we're dealing with the earthquake. We need to cancel the general meeting or something like that.
Well, I was thinking more from...
Staff reports will always be ready, so that's not...
I was thinking more of the political situation and where there's an issue on the agenda that somebody wants and somebody doesn't want to have to deal with, and you could get into that's what I was seeing as the why it shouldn't be done.
Oh, well, in thinking about that, we could do something that says provided that the meeting is canceled at least 1 week in advance. The idea is unless there's an emergency, I guess. Because
sometimes you cancel because of lack of quorum, like, so you don't know you're going to cancel until like the day.
Yeah, it's different, and that's covered in the bylaws separately. Okay. Yeah, if we don't have a quorum within 15 minutes of the start time, then the meeting automatically is canceled.
Okay.
It's kind of like school, right? If the teacher didn't show up with 15 minutes, the kids leave class.
Yeah.
So we can construct some particulars in there
if the rest of the board, jousting at another windmill or something that really won't ever happen. I've just seen some ugly fights over even holding a meeting.
Yeah. Any more discussion on that one?
Yep. Nope. Okay. Moving on.
So the next one I think is pretty important. Well, I think they're all important, but this one's... Agenda items relating to quasi-judicial and enforcement actions pertaining to specific properties. And what I kind of allude to here in this written report, and I'm going to try to characterize the best as I can, is that, you know, your board really kind of has two big different hats that you wear. You wear the hat as legislators, where you're adopting policies and ordinances and establishing staff direction on what we do on a regular day-to-day basis. Separately, you wear the hat of the judge, the jury, and...
Execution.
Yeah, I'm not going to use that word, but... and so I want to speak to that a little bit, because we know that, you know, the theories of democracy in the United States often speak to the three branches of government, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. There is an Annenberg Foundation study done several years ago that said only about a third of the population in the United States could actually name the three branches of government. It's amazing, but our study in civics is not as good as it should be. Where, of course, the legislative branch creates the laws, the executive branch administers the laws, enforces the laws, and the judicial branch, the courts, interpret the laws. Well, that's the federal system, and even though California follows sort of similar, at a local level, you do wear different hats. You are in a quasi-judicial proceedings. And in those situations, you're really having to look at the facts and circumstances of specific cases relating to specific properties. And those can be very time-consuming. They need to sometimes be very diligent in terms of making sure that we're identifying the appropriate board findings of facts and other efforts, and that we know that the courts themselves can be a very slow and scrutinizing type of a process. And so the basic recommendation is that when we get into those situations, let's hold a special meeting on it. Now, if it happens to be that we had three property owners who didn't clean up the dumping and we cited them and we have to put liens on their properties, you know, we try to package those all up at the same time, just like the courts will have, you know, multiple people running through the courtroom at a small time. The other thing that I think about is that these are sensitive issues, and making sure that we're addressing those property owners or those residences and giving them all the respect that's appropriate, as opposed to being under a time crunch in a regular meeting, I think also is important. But I think it's really the diligence of going through that fact-finding and giving whomever it is that we're speaking with the proper respect. The other thing that I think that you may have touched on in your ethics meeting, the ethics discussion, is that when we get into these quasi-judicial meetings, you kind of don't want to limit the ability of the other party to only speak for 3 minutes. You really got to give them their time in order to explain their story. And again, I think special meetings in those situations. Now, we can draft it where we say it may be conducted in a special meeting, as opposed to it shall be constructed in a special meeting, because we might have a thing from time to time that's a pretty minor item that's easy enough to handle during a regular meeting. But I really want to make sure that when we're talking with our constituents, and if they have the disputes on particular issues, that we can say, okay, we can have a focused meeting on it. If they happen to have legal representatives involved, then doing it during, you know, daytime hours is often, a, you know, helps with making sure that parties can have legal representatives. My last comment on this particular topic is, as I think about the different enforcement issues that we're looking at, and there's not a lot, but there's a few things from time to time, and of course we've mostly discussed those in closed session. When they do come up, it's this sort of the institutional that staff, and whether it's at Oceano or whether it's at the county or one of the cities, when we get into the sensitive discussions about enforcement and everything, there's always this inherent aversion to controversy that people have. And when you create a climate in a board chamber that helps to reduce that tension, then the ability to move things forward and to get them resolved helps. So, you know, it almost doesn't matter what we're doing in life. You always think about the climate that you're in. You know, we try to coach our kids, stay out of a bad situation and you're going to be less likely to find yourself in trouble, right? Steer clear of those things. What kind of an environment are we operating in? And so through special meetings, when we're really focused in on, look, we're talking about an enforcement issue, or we're talking about our relationship with a specific property owner, or talking about, you know, it's the one-on-one and not the district's big regular business stuff, then we have a better ability to create a climate that's good for us and it's good for the property owner or their legal representatives to really be able to have the good discussions and resolve issues. But there's a certain hesitation when it's like, oh, we got this controversial item and it's going to be 3 hours at a regular meeting. There's a certain, again, aversion to conflict that people have, and you see it in government all the time. And the problem is if you don't deal with the issue, then it just continues to go. So I think, again, your board has different hats. You work as a legislature and a policy direction body, and that is issues that affect the community as a whole, and those are really important for regular meetings. And in effect, I think the code section somewhere says legislative decisions have to be done at regular meetings. I'm not sure if I have that right or not, but it makes sense. Versus property-specific, quasi-judicial, when we're dealing with specific parties on specific issues to create the climate that this is special and it's part of a special meeting, I think is just, it's both respectful to the other party as well as conducive to helping resolve conflicts.
I'd certainly support that, especially after my ethics class, because they talked about our quasi-judicial responsibilities at that class.
Generally speaking, those would be recorded events. I kind of draw the analogy again to the courts. In courts and judicial proceedings, people are generally allowed to attend. You can go to a murder trial, you can witness a murder trial, but they're not televised events. But for us to record them on tape so that we have, you know, a tape recording, as opposed to, you know, in the courts, you often have a court reporter who's doing everything verbatim. So the basic idea would be special meetings are taped.
I would say, too, I like the idea of wording it in a way that if it is something small, we, you know, just still have it at a regular meeting. As well as, you know, you pointed out, which I think is so true, and it works both ways, being able to focus on the importance of these issues, but also that during the regular meeting, the important issues that we have there, too, allows maybe a little extra time and, you know, don't feel so crammed on trying to get everything in. So, yeah, I agree.
Without further discussion, the next one is direct requests for agenda items. And so I identified three sections that currently point to director requests for agenda items. And those I've thrown out some, pardon me?
Those are all on our in our bylaws?
Yes. And I put out something that says proposed language, but I don't want to indicate that that's final proposed language. It's the concept that I want to address. So, you know, obviously we have future agenda items on our agenda, and during that portion of the agenda that the board can provide direction on, we want to see something on a future agenda. What I'm really trying to address here is the conflict that can develop when a director says, I want to have something on an agenda, and I'm like, ah, it's inconsistent with our existing work priorities. It's not, I can't do it. And so I can't put a staff report together, or I can't do the analysis that's necessary in order to get it on the agenda item. And I believe I have to be able to have the discretion to tell the board member, like, okay, I understand what you're seeking. I just can't get it done. And in that case, it's not that it doesn't go on the agenda, but what it does is it goes under future agenda items, so that the individual board member who's making the request, we can have the open discussion right now that says, okay, is this particular issue a priority? And maybe it is, you know, and maybe, but the point is, if I can't accommodate the director's request, then let's put it under a future agenda item so that we can all have the discussion about if it means changing our priorities or goals, then, you know, we need to talk about changing priorities and goals. So that's one of the points here. But a good comparison is agenda item 8A, President White asked me on Friday the 13th, well, I don't think it was a ask, it was a request.
It was a request.
I would like to see the second fire engine on the next agenda. Well,
I think I said we need the fire because of the time limit of the Five Cities Fire Authority.
And I know on that particular request, even though it wasn't part of scheduled work, I wasn't going to say no, right? The timing, February 1st, there's a $50,000 discount that's available. So what we did is we changed the game plan a little bit. We got it on there. We were otherwise going to have our final adoption of some of the solid waste programs on tonight's agenda. There was no problem in pushing that to the next agenda. So that was a request that it was timely, it was important, and could be accommodated. And so obviously, as the general manager, when we're talking about these issues, I'm going to do my best to get the item on the agenda. But the language, again, says, okay, if I'm not, it's got to be a discretion on my part. It would be a bad decision had I told President White no, right? And I believe in making good decisions.
Well, I think somewhere in there maybe you can put the issue of timeliness. Or deadlines, or I don't know how you'd word it, because it's not a final draft anyway, but, you know, because that can be an issue.
And I agree. I did get that, though, President. The general manager shall consider the timing of the request.
Okay.
How the request compares to existing work and priorities. And so tonight wasn't really about scouring this language because we're going to...
Well, I even have it underlined on my notes.
Yeah.
So I got it. I just didn't remember.
And the point is that if I'm in that compromising position where I'm like, I can't get a staff report together, well, we'll still get it on the agenda as a future agenda item so that we can talk about it. The only other thing I wanted to note here is, and actually, it's the next item, so we'll just leave that with that.
Okay. Moving on. Next one is...
Communication between the general manager and individual board members, including distribution of information and analysis. And so one of the points that I make here is that there's a difference between information and analysis, and I draw a little bit of an analogy to the public records request. That with a public records request, we're obligated to provide information. We're not obligated to provide analysis. If a board member asks me for some analysis, and it's an easy one, like what's the percentage increase in our Zone 3 budget from last year to this year? Well, you know, that's a 15-second analysis, crunching a couple numbers, not a big deal. But if the analysis really is akin to a future agenda item, then we need to move it to future agenda items, and it's not an information request. But the basic other idea is here, when I get information requests, that I distribute it to all the board members, because as informational, I think it helps each board member understand what the other board members are looking for in terms of information, and that's good. We know that it has to stick to distribution of information so that we're not going to violate the Brown Act. And then the other item in here is the third is the language that I think it would be good to put in our policies that prohibits the general manager from essentially telling one board member what another board member is thinking. Because if the general manager were to do so, then that automatically prevents board member A from seeking input from any other board member that they might want to do. So I think
it's... Serial meeting laws.
Yes. And as a general manager, it kind of protects me a little bit from a board member who might say, so what does that other board member think? You know, and I don't know how much discussion has gone on between the different board members, but I can point back to the bylaws and say, well, I'm not really supposed to disclose to you what other board member... If you want to know what that other board member thinks and you haven't talked to any other board members... Then approach the board member and first ask them, have you discussed this with any other board members? I would like to discuss it with you. And you kind of go through that procedure of making sure that you're both clear to talk about the particular topic and not have any Brown Act violations. So twofold, I think it's good as to incorporate it in there so general managers in the future especially will look at it and say, okay, I can't be talking to board members about what the others think. And then it also provides the general manager with some protection, again, in case you have a prying board member, and you know, which, of course, we're not talking about existing board members. We're talking about that devious board member that might be elected somehow in the future. So I think, again, you know, to put some in there regarding communications between general manager and individual board members would be good along these lines.
Do we want to get into computer? The issue of the danger of computers, reply all and all that stuff, or do is that, I mean, this is bylaws, so it probably doesn't need to be in.
May I comment on
Yes.
this? I think generally speaking, we're aware of the application of the Brown Act. I think the bylaws even now say that this is a board operating under the Brown Act, so we don't want to I don't think it helps to restate Brown Act provisions in the bylaws, and that's just an independent source of information, similar to conflict of interest codes, and that's that type of thing.
They're out there in another document. Yeah, thank you.
On the evaluation of consultants, so Section 12 provides, and we haven't been doing this, that consultants and legal counsel shall be evaluated annually during the months of May or June. Doesn't say whether the board does it or just I do it. If it's in the board bylaws, it's kind of seems like it's implied that it would be a board evaluation. And it kind of makes me wonder, well, gosh, how did that get in there? Because it's kind of unusual. Boards don't usually evaluate consultants. We've seen some local examples where if a governing body has a problem with their consultant, they'll usually investigate, they get into closed session, they talk about the issues. It's really important. You know, and it gets into the issues of, is the consultant breaching their contract? And so there are established methods for dealing with issues that might arise when we question the performance of consultants. And so I just wondered, well, you know, what's the benefit? My guess is that sometime in the past, the district may have had a challenge with a particular consultant, and this got inserted into the bylaws as sort of a way of a quick brainstorm on how to deal with those situations. But the reality is we have contracts with consultants, and if we have problems, then there's plenty of ways to address those particular problems. And in some ways, I think that's very strong with consultants. And, you know, generally speaking, the consultants directly report to the general manager. So like staff, and of course your board doesn't evaluate staff. Instead, if staff's not doing their job, you evaluate me on why I can't get staff to do their job, right? So the only contrast is district legal counsel does provide advice directly to your governing board. That's the unique nature of legal counsel. But again, if we're having challenges with legal counsel, then we have ways to deal with them. So again, I think that this Section 12 was kind of probably inserted into the bylaws in response to something that happened in the past, but it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me because in the situations where we are challenged there, we have, you know, it's going to be case specific. It's not going to happen in May or June, or if it does, then that's coincidental. And there's plenty of ways to address those types of issues.
So what about waterboarding?
The next one is the board members trained for national incident management, and I don't understand this at all.
Yeah, so this one kind of jumped out at me because my first reaction was, it says every year board members are going to be trained, Section 13.1, board members are trained on the National Incident Management System. And I've gone done two times I've gone back to Emmitsville, Maryland, first with Atascadero Fire and then second with Five Cities Fire. Is a big group that gets, you know, we run through a lot of drills and get trained on emergency response and everything. But elected officials don't drill into that. And during emergencies, it tends to be the role that elected officials need to step back. You know, your emergency individuals, whether it's, you know, Five Cities Fire or other emergency responders, whether it's the sheriff, our countywide emergency plans, if there is certain types of threats, the FBI, the CIA, I don't know about Homeland Security, the FBI are going to be in town. And the way it's organized is, you know, the locals will be organized and the law enforcement will coordinate, you know, with federal and state agencies in dealing with immediate responses. And the important situation is to make sure that elected officials, like the president, is there and being kept abreast of how the emergency is evolving. Because who is it that during emergencies are often talking with the press? It's the elected officials, right? And that's really important because the public needs to hear from the elected officials and their leadership as to whatever the prognosis is. So the experts during the emergency are going to be doing the evaluations. They're going to be assessing risks. They're going to be talking about whether or not the community center has to be opened for people who need to leave their homes and, you know, it's not health and welfare, but it's cover, you know, for protection. Yeah. So these decisions are going to be made. Everybody, including like the Red Cross, is involved in those things. And the message, though, to the public needs to often come from the elected officials who are there in the rooms, they understand what's going on, and then provides the message to the public that, look, we have the community center open, you can go there, or the other types of communications that need to be happening. So when I saw this broad language under 1613.1 that requires board members are trained on National Incident Management System, I immediately saw this big, huge thing that I've been used to working on in my career. And so then I went to the website that I linked on what they have in terms of their update, their training program. And I found two particular training sections that FEMA does recommend for senior elected and appointed official and it's G402, which is the Incident Command System Overview for Executives and Senior Officials, and then G191 is training based on jurisdiction risk and or specific interest. And so I have reached out to the state because FEMA said you need to contact your state representatives to find out what they're making available in terms of G402 and G191 training. So I've made the call. I haven't gotten the call back. But my thought is to focus NIMS training on these two sections or these two items that the overall program recommends for elected officials. I've got some more research to do on it, but it seems to me that that would be sort of the appropriate level. And it's my instincts are it's the same sort of level of training on AB 1234 and ethics, and it's the same level of training that your board gets on things like discriminatory harassment prevention training. So not on the entirety of the National Incident Management System, but on those specific items that they recommend for elected officials.
Well, it seems to me that our basic jobs are making policy and handling a budget. And I don't see us... I mean, yeah.
And waterboarding the general manager and legal counsel.
Yeah. And waterboarding the general manager. It just seems to me that we could really be in the way. Now, maybe sitting at a desk signing checks might be, but I'm just...
Well, and that's why I want to look at the two that they recommend, because I have a feeling that some of them are directly on point with the idea of communicating with the public during emergencies and what's the role of the elected official.
Yeah.
So I think those might very well be noteworthy, but again.
I think me out in the field trying to help you would be, I would get in the way. It's just the same way I feel about the fire department. I'm chairman of the board, but my job is to see that they have enough money in trucks to go out and put the fire out. I don't need to go put the fire out.
And I agree 100%. And it's this, so Doug Grosshart, our district engineer, called me today and he started talking about CHC and the work that they're doing. And, you know, the modifications to our system. And he's kind of going on and on, and I'm like, Doug, I'm not following, because he's talking about pipes in the ground, and I don't have a picture in front of me. I said, is it all open? And he says, yes. And I said, well, okay, I'll come out and take a look at what you're talking about. But I didn't go out in order to tell him what to do. I just went out there so I could see what he was talking about. And then once I recognized what he was talking about, then I was able to say, well, you know, this seems like this is CHC's obligation, and this would be our obligation, but let's make sure, whatever, you just get it right, you know? But I only went out there in order to make sure I understood what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And then I left because I didn't want to get in their way. I didn't want to interfere with his discussions with the contractors in the field. But, you know, he needed me out there just for a minute so that he could explain what the situation is. And so, yeah, sometimes if you get too many involved in the middle of those decisions, then you just don't do yourself justice.
I can see how it would have been 10 years ago when this board was totally hands-on. Or before, I mean, when the fire department was volunteer and when everything was starting. I can see where...
Yeah.
It would have been a different situation.
Yeah, and if you go back decades, especially in the example of volunteer fire departments, so we still have a couple in the county, like Santa Margarita is its own independent fire department. It's a volunteer. So everybody who's on the board, I shouldn't say everybody, but the people who are on the board are volunteer firefighters at the same time.
Yeah.
But that model of local agency governments is, you know, more of a way of the past than it is of
Well, we've grown up
date.
A little.
Yes. So in terms of this discussion overall, I know that I've received feedback to work with for your board. The next step is for me to, you know, work through those other attached policies, do some comparisons to our language, and we'll just keep plugging away on it.
This other list.
Yeah, so that was my quick comparison of our bylaws to the CSDA policy, draft policy. And President White, maybe you can help me. What's that page number on there?
It's page 94 of 163. Yeah.
And so on page 94 of 163, what I've listed in, there's two different series. There's series 4000 on the Board of Directors and then series 5000 policy regarding board meetings. And these are all the particulars that CSDA lays out. So I put checks next to every one of the policies that we have addressed at least to some extent in our bylaws. And then there's open boxes on those CSDA policies that we don't address anywhere in our bylaws. So, for example, CSDA draft policy 4015 regards voluntary candidate expenditure ceilings, and that's the idea that some local agencies put like campaign contribution limitations into effect. Mm-hmm. I think that there was a local agency who had a member who was fined by the agency for apparently accidentally violating that provision of the particular city. We don't have anything like that in our bylaws, so that's why it has an open box. Director's health insurance is also an open box because we don't have anything in our bylaws on that particular measure.
It's come up in the past.
Yeah, and I know I have a sister who's been a longstanding board member on a school district in Southern California. They happen to provide their board members with health insurance benefit. But again, the idea is I check the boxes where we have some language in our bylaws particular to that particular draft policy, and then open boxes where we don't have any language. And so in step two, when we're doing the comparison to the CSDA policies to what we have, then that's when we'll address those in greater detail and gain an understanding of what your board's preferences are.
Okay. Questions, comments?
Even though there's no board direction, public comment would still be appropriate.
Call for public comment. Nobody coming forward. I guess we can move on unless the board has any more comments. Okay. Utility items. move on to 9, utility items. 10, hearing items. 11, received written communications. 12, late written communications.
So all the written communications that, you know, I've identified, the both the local hazard mitigation plan and the next steps on that, as well as the county's staff's recommendations for no public facility fee funding, I've already discussed as part of those agenda items.
Your
board might want to consider taking 14 future agenda items prior to going into closed session.
We can go ahead and then move back to 13.
Okay, so on 14 future agenda items, what I want to do more so than in the past is to just identify the items that are coming up. So 2017 goals, the bylaws continued in the solid waste programs, I would anticipate those all on the next meeting. Public facilities fees, not in the immediate future, but in the near future, because we do need to update a lot of information on public facilities fees and provide that back to the county. It also may be relevant to Five Cities Fire Authority and whether or not the other agencies want to adopt public facilities fees. But currently, we collect ours through the county because they're the land use agency. The SSMP, which is the Sewer System Management Plan, we have to do a biannual audit. So Casey is going to have responsibilities there, and Casey Stewart, and I'll be working with him. That will be to your board probably in the March time frame. As I mentioned, the emergency generator, we have simply need to get our informal bid package together to be able to take the next step on that. I previously mentioned that professional services proposals for the work that your board has authorized, either for the utility yard as well as the work efforts associated with Prop 84, will be coming back in the next couple months. And we talked a little bit about the question of do we want to invite the district administrator from South County Sanitation District to come and do an overview of their CIP efforts is something that your board may want to consider. And with respect to the Zone 3 budget, I think that's the one that we probably want to get feedback on more immediately. As Director Brunet had pointed out, the cost increase that the county is talking about for Oceano is slightly less than 1.5%. And we have the pass-through provisions in Prop 218, so that's basically not going to have any negative impact. In fact, your board adopted it, the board has adopted a two-year budget, and the county's projections for next fiscal year are around $6,000 roughly underneath what we already have adopted for next year's budget. So in some years, the board has deliberated the Zone 3 budget and provided direction. Some years not. An alternative that we might consider is that simply during the third quarter budget review, staff could take some time and walk through how the Zone 3 budget is constructed. And but again, I don't see, there's not, you know, big fiscal implications with Zone 3. So feedback tonight as to whether you want to have a specific item on the Zone 3 budget to provide Director Brunet with direction when he goes back, and they'll be considering at their March meeting, versus just including a general discussion of the Zone 3 budget during the third quarter budget review. Obtaining board direction on that. You know, the contrast is Five Cities Fire Authority, because it's we're a JPA member. We always do that budget discussion. But on Zone 3, in some ways, you know, we live with what the county decides. And
I was gonna say.
Yeah, if we're seeing large, there was a period of time, of course, when Lopez was getting constructed and the water treatment plant was getting constructed, where we're seeing significant cost increases. And to discuss those and everything and to say, okay, can we give feedback to the county, or should Zone 3 be challenging the county? That I just don't see as being in the cards right now. But in the past it was, and in fact that kind of feedback from the member agencies, and in one year in particular from Arroyo Grande, compelled the county to develop a capital policy, a capital project funding policy, in order to eliminate the ups and downs, volatility, and what the county charges to the local agencies. So when time to time comes and things, you know, hiccups or other issues come up, then scouring the Zone 3 budget makes sense. But again, it's the board's preference. So you want to have a specific item prior to Director Brunet reporting back to Zone 3 in March, or are you fine with just doing a part of a general review during the third quarter budget update?
Jim, what do you think?
I don't know. Andrew, do you have a preference on whether you are directed to act in a certain fashion? You want to swing with the flow? What do you see in the budget Zone 3?
I mean, I think with what the proposed budget is currently, and just with the comments that Mr. Ogren made, that at this point, probably just a review of it at the quarterly budget review.
Third quarter
budget review, I think would be sufficient. But.
That seems consistent with Pavel's described, yeah. As far as I see.
Okay, so...
Seems fine.
Yeah, so that's how we're approach it as a future agenda item. And it sounds like, in general, the board would like me to reach out to Administrator Gerhardt and see what kind of timing would work for him to... Yeah. I know he's done some of the presentations for the other agencies as well, so I'll do reach out on that. So with that, I don't know if there's other future agenda items that board members might want to put out on the table.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah, tell Gerhardt he's got 3 minutes. No, I think it would be good, even okay. Although we have our own policy, not policies, but what's the word? I can't say it anyway.
Procedure.
We've made our own decisions on that already. I mean, yes. We've made our feelings known. Yeah. Okay. Move on to closed session. Mr. Minery, please.
For the benefit of the television audience, there is no longer public in attendance for public comment. So pursuant to Government Code 54957, Performance Evaluation of the General Manager, 13B, pursuant to Government Code 54956.9D2, Conference with Legal Counsel Regarding Anticipated Litigation, there is one case.
Adjourn? Not adjourn.
Yes,
adjourn to closed session.